This is a CBC podcast. We'll pose the questions. Do you have the answers? Every week, Canada Reads is giving away a set of all five books from this year's competition. We'll ask a new question every Monday on the website. Share your answer in the comments and you could win. Go to cbc.ca/CanadaReads for more.
My delegation totally reject the so-called Commission of Inquiry on the human rights situation in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
The North Koreans were denouncing it before it was even finished, perhaps because they already knew just how damning it would be. The UN Commission of Inquiry on Human Rights in North Korea quotes survivors of prison camps documenting murder, enslavement, torture, and imprisonment as part of government policy. Now that the members of the UN cannot say they do not know, what will they do to help the people of North Korea? Also today, her ads show a disciplined runner tackling a hill.
I set goals. Really hard to accomplish goals. I never stop until they're done.
When she took over as Premier of Ontario, Kathleen Wynne bolted forward with a breathlessly ambitious political agenda, but she is chased by the legacy of her own Liberal predecessor, along with opposition parties that could topple her minority government and political rivals in Ottawa who are nipping at her heels. In half an hour, we catch up with Kathleen Wynne 1 year into the job. And it was a bad horror film in the 60s.
Where will the bodies turn up next? Run! You can't escape the shock of corruption.
But now corruption is playing out in every country in the EU. A new study identifies hundreds of billions of dollars lost to various forms of corruption in every one of 28 EU countries. And those who track these things say the numbers would be even higher if we counted corrupt government practices built right into legislation. In an hour, we're talking accountability, deniability, and the sensibility that makes so many suspicious of corruption in developing countries while not even noticing what happens at home in developed nations. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. This is The Current.
An anonymous former police official described the camps this way.
The camps are a living hell. I've seen people beaten and tortured there many times. I worked for the Ministry of People's Security from 1995 to about 2003, so I went to Camp 18 several times. When I saw the lives of the prisoners, I'd be the first to kill myself if I had to live there.
Kim Ye-suk was a prisoner at Camp 18. Her whole family was put there when her grandfather escaped to South Korea.
They would signal for us to come over and make us sit down. There was a position in which we all had to sit. We'd put our hands behind our backs and kneel, then raise our heads and open our mouths. They'd spit phlegm into our mouths. If we swallowed, they wouldn't hit us. But if we gagged, then they would beat us badly.
Well, those are excerpts from a Human Rights Watch video of interviews with North Korean prison camp survivors. The interviews were conducted in Korean, and the video contains subtitles, some of which we voiced for that clip. This all coincides with a damning report prepared by the UN Commission of Inquiry on Human Rights in North Korea. It details evidence of war crimes and crimes against humanity, including murder, rape, torture, abductions, enslavement, starvation. The report's based on a year-long investigation that heard from defectors, including former inmates and guards in North Korea's notorious prison camps. Michael Kirby is the chair of the Commission of Inquiry on Human Rights in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, otherwise known as North Korea. He's joining us from Geneva. Michael Kirby, welcome back to The Current.
Well, thank you for having me again.
You have heard so many stories, such as those translated in the clips we just heard. It's so difficult to listen to even those little snippets. I'm wondering how you listened to so much for this inquiry.
Well, don't forget that I had been a judge in Australia for 34 years before I came to this responsibility. And although I'd heard and read the evidence of hundreds of trials involving terribly wrong and cruel acts, nothing really prepared me for the enormity, the duration, the affront of the terrible crimes that were described as having happened in North Korea.
North Korea's government refused to participate in the investigation. Remind us how you did gather evidence.
We decided, unusually for UN commissions of inquiry, to proceed by way of public hearings. Normally, things are done by sort of private, on-the-spot consultations, and we decided that the best way to respond to the refusal of North Korea to engage was to conduct our investigation as far as possible in the open. We gathered it by oral testimony. Our report is illustrated throughout by reference to the witnesses who gave their evidence. And also, we gathered it by way of official reports, experts who spent a lifetime investigating North Korea, and satellite images, which were available to confirm the statements about the prison camps. So there wasn't really a great difficulty in getting the evidence, and I'm perfectly satisfied that the evidence we got was overwhelmingly completely truthful and also illustrative of what people go through in life in North Korea.
In this report, you draw a clear link from the abuses, everything from starvation, rape, murder, enslavement, to government policies. How significant is that?
It's absolutely crucial for the purpose of one of the aspects of our mandate, which was set for us by the Human Rights Council. We were asked to identify which of the cases of human rights abuses that were demonstrated in the evidence rose to the level of being a crime against humanity. Crimes against humanity involve very serious crimes of violence against the civilian population committed deliberately and as an aspect of state policy. And applying those criteria to the testimony that we received, quite a lot of the human rights infractions did rise to that level. Those relating to the prison camps, those relating to starvation of the population, those relating to abduction, those relating to public executions. And we identified all those and then turned our attention to the second question that was posed for us, which was, how can we ensure accountability by those responsible for those crimes?
Is the leader of North Korea, does he need to be tried for this? Who does face accountability?
We are not, of course, a judicial tribunal, nor are we an official prosecutor. And therefore, we don't have the final say in those questions. What we had to do was to gather the evidence and analyze it and present it to the international community through the United Nations and the Human Rights Council. What we've done is to identify a number of people who would be responsible. Some have been identified earlier, such as those who have been identified as having been involved in the abductions, including abductions of Japanese nationals. But ultimately, North Korea is a very centralized administration, and a lot of the power comes back to the supreme leader. That's the way the state is organized. He is the head of the party, the head of the military, the head of the security service, the head guru of the country, and the supreme leader. And therefore, we felt obliged to draw to his notice that he personally might be responsible under international law for these crimes, for aiding and abetting them, or failing to stop them when he had the power to do so.
Now, the commission is urging referral to the International Criminal Court, and North Korea is not a signatory to that treaty. How can that request move forward? Can you help us understand?
There is a particular provision in the Rome Statute setting up the International Criminal Court, which gives the Security Council of the United Nations a power to refer a question to the International Criminal Court, even in respect of acts that have been done in or by a country that is not a signatory to the Rome Statute. And North Korea, as you've said, is such a country. And that's what we've suggested. Now, whether that will happen or not will depend upon the affirmative votes of the five permanent members. And the five permanent members include China. And that will be a question that will be unfolding in the weeks and months ahead.
Michael Kirby, thank you for speaking with me today.
It's my duty. Thank you.
Michael Kirby is the chair of the Commission of Inquiry on Human Rights in the Democratic People's Republic of North Korea, otherwise known as North Korea. He joined us from Geneva. North Korea said Monday it categorically and totally rejects the findings of the report, claiming it was faked by hostile forces backed by the U.S., the European Union, and Japan. Pyongyang added that the people behind the report were, and the quote is, human scum. Well, for those following and working on these kinds of issues, the report on North Korea is long overdue. But what it will ultimately mean for the history books remains an open question. Roberta Cohen is co-chair of the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. She's in our Washington studio. Bruce Klingner is a senior researcher for Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation. He's a longtime observer of North Korea, and from 1996 to 2001, he was the deputy division chief for the CIA on North Korea. Bruce Klingner is in Silver Spring, Maryland. Hello to you both.
Good morning.
Morning.
Roberta Cohen, let's start with you. How significant is this report?
It's tremendously significant. Even though North Korea is totally rejecting the report, it's going to have to take it into account. This is the first time that a UN body has recognized that the North Korean government is committing not just ordinary human rights violations, but crimes against humanity, and that those responsible have to be held accountable. It's a kind of a neon sign. Now, it has to be seen as part of a larger strategy to promote human rights. It's not an end in itself. The rest of the international community is going to have to begin to see that this happens. Now, the findings are going to influence a number of governments to take into account human rights in their policies and priorities. You'll notice that the Group of Eight, of which Canada is a member in 2013 for the first time, talked about human rights in North Korea as a way of improving the situation and relations with these other countries in North Korea. It's not just denuclearization anymore. The findings may also act as a deterrent to some of the border guards and prison guards in these camps. There's even been a little evidence over the past few years. There's a fear of being held accountable once the regime falls. Finally, I think that it's important, it's a sign for everyone to get behind the very courageous North Koreans inside who are risking their lives by escaping, by telling stories, and there are North Koreans inside that are giving out information. The least that can be done by the international community is to try to build up a reinforced support for them when there is readiness to have this connection of the outside world with the inside world. And okay. I think it's very important that everybody put North Korea, the government, on notice that human rights will be on the agenda with North Korea.
Bruce Klingner, Michael Kirby has said that this brings back memories of the end of the Second World War. The report actually says, and I'm quoting here, the gravity of these violations reveal a state that does not have any parallel in the contemporary world. Have you ever heard the United Nations use this kind of language to describe a sitting regime?
Right. It really is a regime that's a combination of Nazi Germany, Soviet Russia, and George Orwell's 1984. The details of the report point out that these are not just crimes occurring in the gulags, but the regime, every aspect of society is being used to, you know, imprison the citizens in their country, forced starvation and others is just really a damning indictment of the North Korean regime. As Mr. Kirby said, unfortunately, we won't see Kim Jong-un standing in the dock of justice immediately because the report has to be referred to the ICC by the UN Security Council. And unfortunately, China has shown it's already willing to impede this important document. But as Roberta said, I think it will have indirect effects that could be quite significant.
You know, I guess as well, the a lot of this is information we know from human rights workers and academics and journalists who have been documenting some of this. But for the UN to put this out in a report, its members cannot say they do not know. Am I right, Bruce Klinger?
Exactly. And as Mr. Kirby's report shows, is that, you know, it really is, in a way, an indictment of the international community. You know, he points out that these crimes have been going on for so long, and that the international community surely has known about it and really has done nothing. So, you know, in that sense, we hope that the report will be, will induce some actions by, if not the UN Security Council, by a number of nations around the world.
Roberta Cohen, how realistic is it to think that there could be some kind of trial or tribunal that takes this further with prosecutions?
I think this is a longer-term goal. Right now, there will be a lot of political challenges to that, as Justice Kirby pointed out. The Chinese in the Security Council may well veto having the case brought before the International Criminal Court. What's important is that a foundation gets laid that leads to this. After all, how did we even get to a commission of inquiry? When the first UN resolution was adopted, that was in 2005, the General Assembly adopted a resolution on human rights in North Korea, and there were 88 states that supported it and others rejected or abstained. By 2012, all states, it was a consensus vote on human rights in North Korea. It takes a bit of time. This led to then looking into crimes against humanity in the country, and now we have findings. So I think one has to take a longer view. The foundation must be built up. Non-governmental organizations, international organizations, governments must begin to act on these findings. Harness this information, harness the findings to effective strategies, to raising this with the North Koreans, to raising it internationally, to trying to break through the walls in North Korea by having people-to-people exchanges and discussions. There are a lot of strategies that can be adopted. And I was very impressed by the Mongolian president who went to Pyongyang and said publicly, tyranny doesn't last forever, and linked economic involvement in the country with improvement in human rights. So I think if more and more governments that North Korea might turn to for economic relations, for investment, for support in some way, begin to raise human rights issues, this begins to pave the way, and China could become increasingly uncomfortable defending a North Korea that is such a pariah in the international community.
Well, let me pick up on that, because UN investigators single out China's relationship with North Korea. Do you think the international community is ready to hold China to account for its relationship?
This report holds China to account. That is what's so interesting about it. I mean, one of the more interesting features of it. It mentions China by name. It shows complicity at the border with China forcing back North Koreans that try to escape from the country. And so China it'll be quite embarrassed by this report. And there are voices in think tanks in China, even in the party, that question its relationship with North Korea. And that is a healthy sign. So I think China is going to find the price of supporting this regime unconditionally increasingly difficult, and there may have to be some adjustments made. Behind the scenes, for sure, you'll just hear a lot of defensiveness now, both from China and from North Korea. But then I think that there may be some effort at making some changes.
Bruce Klinger, is there anything in this report that should have gone further? There's no call for regime change. Do they need
one? Well, I think, as Roberta said, it is important because it lays a legal foundation. I mean, now North Korea will always be labeled with or linked to the moniker of a perpetrator of crimes against humanity. And China also should be always linked with the moniker of the defender and facilitator of North Korean crimes against humanity. So I think the effect will be more indirect. What we hope, a number of things. One is that South Korea will finally pass a North Korean human rights bill. The progressives or liberals in the legislature in Seoul have been hesitant to do so because they feel it undermines engagement. But hopefully this will spur Seoul to do that. Also, it may spur the U.S. Congress to further actions to impose more sanctions against North Korea. The House of Representatives has pending legislation, and the Senate is considering additional legislation, as we have against Iran and other regimes. And, you know, there are a number of things that could still be done against North Korea, the targeted financial measures that, contrary to the perception of North Korea as the most heavily sanctioned country in the world, that's actually not true. We have far greater sanctions against Iran, which I would argue is one of the reasons Tehran came back to the negotiating table.
But given the poverty that North Koreans already face, would sanctions only hurt them?
No, not at all, because the sanctions are targeted measures against the regime. They're not general sanctions against the populace. And there are a number of things that we've already done, the U.S. has already done to Iran and Burma and Syria that we have not yet done to North Korea, which sort of counterintuitively. So there are a number of things we can do, as we were doing in 2005 when the U.S. labeled a Macau bank that was facilitating North Korean money laundering. That had a huge effect on North Korean regime finances, and yet, unfortunately, the U.S. backed off of that.
Roberta Cohen and Bruce Klingner, thank you for your thoughts today.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Roberta Cohen is co-chair of the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. She's a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. She was in Washington, D.C. Bruce Klingner is a senior researcher for Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation. Just outside of Washington, D.C., we reached him in Silver Spring, Maryland. Now, we've posted links to much of the testimony from survivors of the North Korean prison camps and the hearings of the U.N. Commission of Inquiry. One of the people who testified was Shin Dong-hyuk. He is believed to be the only person born in a North Korean prison camp who actually escaped one. You may remember we spoke to him on The Current. Reporter Blaine Harden chronicled Shin's journey in his book Escape from Camp 14. And the interview with the two of them from last year on The Current has been posted on our link, cbc.ca/thecurrent, if you'd like to hear that. Stay with us. The news is next. And when we return, we'll be speaking to the Premier of Ontario, Kathleen Wynne, talking about her first year on the job. This is The Current on CBC Radio 1.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.